of the world. The Vanderveer lot thrummed with chaos. Harley had taken off from the party in his little gig without waiting for Jacob, but now Jacob, his lantern swinging wildly, darted between the towering stacks of lumber, searching for the overseer, who he thought had preceded him to the district. But the man was nowhere. Irritated, Jacob abandoned the fruitless search and tried to get a sense of what could be done with the dozens of Vanderveer men who had reported. Underfoot, slush and mud were making the going hellish, and the river ice was cracking and roaring as it gave way. In Harley's place, Jacob directed the men to load the flat barges with as much lumber as the ships could carry. Canal boats that had frozen in the slips during the blizzard could carry 165,000 board feet. A good save, and every board foot they preserved was money in everyone's pocket. The men responded to Jacob's shouted instructions, crawling onto the stacks, manning ropes and pulleys, and leaping onto barges to receive the payloads. They worked hard and fast, wary eyes peering into the darkness toward the river, their backs bent to the job. The only light came from bobbing lanterns and the silver shine of a half-moon reflected on banks of low clouds. No one knew how much time they had, or how many hours they worked. But to a man, bones grew weary, and sweat poured from them like a fire hose. Suddenly, an enormous cry broke through the chaos, as lookouts posted on the river shore shouted, "Now! Now! Now!" Men abandoned their work on the spot and bolted. They thundered past Jacob, vanishing into the night, urging him to follow. But instead, Jacob hunted every inch of blackness, and only when he'd verified that every last one of their men had vacated the lot did he race to the Vanderveer lumber office to retrieve the company books, which contained the record of every transaction the company had ever made. This retrieval had been his father's sole aim in sending Jacob tonight, but Harley's absence, and his father's, had forced Jacob to perform the overseer's responsibilities until this last minute. The office occupied a square of land adjacent to the main road that ran along the riverside of the district, but the office was a good 100 feet from the shore. The location was advantageous, close to the lock bridge, serviced by the district trolley, just steps away from one of the big sawmills. All day long, the scent of sawdust and the whine of the enormous band saw penetrated the two-room edifice, where his father reigned as the king of lumber. His father had built the impressive office a decade ago, when the company's coffers had swelled after the war. With a view to impressing clients, Garrett had spent $8,000 on an elegant building crafted not of lumber, but of brick, a heretical ode to profitability. Its French roof rose 20 feet, and the walls inside were paneled in black walnut. It was the envy of the other dealers, and his father's pride and joy. Dredging the key ring from his pocket, Jacob juggled the lantern, fumbling as he unlocked the door. The river sounded like a freight train. He tripped on the raised threshold as he went in, slammed the door, and rushed through the reception room with its high sales counter and overstuffed chairs into his father's office in the back. There he kept his big combination vault, hidden behind a panel door fashioned to look like the wall. He rounded his father's wide oak desk and dialed the lock, his fingers trembling. Outside, chunks of ice battered the north bridge, grinding against it. He misdialed and began again, his fingers feeling like jelly. After an eon, the tumblers locked into place. Jacob hefted the bolt, swung open the lead door, and began rummaging, loading ledgers into the crook of his elbow. In all, 15 volumes of the history of Vanderveer lumber. He had no idea that his father kept so many. He stuffed them one after the other into a thick burlap sack, scooped up piles of greenbacks, slammed the door shut, twirled the lock, snagged the lantern, and charged out of the inner office and back through the front room with his spoils. He yanked the outside door open an inch. Black, icy water surged in around his feet. Heart pounding, he strong-armed the door shut, but somehow water kept seeping in underfoot. He stood there, panting. There was no going outside. The river would sweep him away. How long had he been inside? 2 minutes? Less? He skidded back through the front room to his father's heavy oak desk and heaved the burlap bag atop, plunked the lantern beside it, and clambered on top too, breathing hard, making rapid calculations. He recalled his father's warnings at the cemetery. If the freshet turned out to be as bad as his father predicted, the building might fill with water. And fast. And if the river rose above 20 feet, which it sometimes did, rarely, but still, the office would be completely submerged. Gulping air, he fought panic, reeling with fury at Harley. Where was that man? If he'd shown up to do his job, Jacob could have retrieved the books straight away. He would not now be facing a watery grave. Furthermore, where was his father? He'd thought he was just behind him. Had he said that he was coming? The ominous splash of lumber piles toppling and ice smashing made it impossible to think. What was essential? Staying alive. For a brief moment, he thought of Elizabeth. They had not walked far, just down to Willett Street and back under flowering horse chestnut trees, but then they had sat on a neighbor's steps, whispering together about Paris and the conservatoire. Elizabeth had confided the relentless criticism her instructor had heaped on her, her overwhelming sense of failure, the sadness of everything she had loved vanishing from her life, all of it pouring out of her in a rush. He had taken her gloved hands in his, and did not relinquish them until she finished. A huge crash thundered through the air, slabs of ice keeling over. Underfoot, water already lapped halfway up the solid desk. Where was it coming in? From underneath the floorboards, maybe? Frantic, Jacob took inventory in the flickering lantern light. At some point, he had lost the kerosene tin. Soon the oil would run out, and he would be plunged into pitch blackness. His eyes raked the shelves, searching for anything of use. Then he remembered. In the front room, his father kept an altar to the lumber business. Links of grappling chain, a long cant hook, an even longer, sharp-pronged peavey, a mass of lethal picaroons, and one double-bitted axe. He lowered himself into the freezing waters and gasped. He towed forward, uncertain of the flooring. There was little current. A vase bobbed by, an oil lamp. Holding his lantern high, he headed for the front room. The double-sided axe hung suspended on nails on the wall, high above the sales counter. Heaving himself up, he grappled for it and knocked it off its hooks. It splashed into the water beside him. He grabbed for it, just snagging the curved wooden handle before it drifted away. His legs were already numb. One hand grasping the axe, the other the lantern, he drifted like a ghost back through the water, thinking rather than feeling his way. Shivering, he lugged himself onto the desk and pulled his legs up one by one. He was shuddering, cold through. He crawled to his hands and knees, staggered to a stand. The desk was heavy enough to stay put for a while, but water could carry anything away. For a brief moment, he had a sense of the walls of his heart dissolving. He had just been born, and now he might die. A vision flickered before him. His mother, weeping. He was not dressed for exertion. He was dressed for a dinner party. He began wildly, swinging the axe. Chapter 15. At the first peal of bells, Emma was on her feet. She'd been dreaming, and now she was awake, and she didn't know why. Earlier, she and Claire had fallen asleep under a new blanket that the man had promised would ward off the chill of the stone walls. It hadn't. She was always cold. The dream was her favorite one. She dreamed it all the time. It was about stars in the sky, and a ladder that dropped down from heaven, and a little man who wore a sparkling top hat, who reached over the starry ledge to beckon Emma and Claire to climb the ladder into the shimmer, away from all the pain. The nearby church bell, the one that rang on Sunday mornings, was banging back and forth in its tower. Above the sound of the bell, the high shriek of the lumber district whistle wailed too. The lumber district siren used to mean that her father was coming home from work. Now it meant that the man was coming back. But it wasn't morning, and it wasn't evening. It was dark. Emma blinked into the blackness, looking first, as she always did, to the top of the stairs to see whether or not the man was coming down. He always came down first if the other man was coming, to admonish Emma into cooperation, to carry Claire away. But the door wasn't opening. On the street, yellow lantern light flashed around the black shadows of the window boxes. Hollow calls of panic and worry floated in the air. The bell was the one that rang so loudly on Sundays. Yes, for certain, it was the church bell. But it wasn't Sunday morning now, was it? And the siren had already sounded for that night. And the man wasn't coming down the stairs. At least, not yet. Claire woke and began to weep, and Emma wrapped her arms around Claire's waist and petted her hair. Think! Until this moment, the ringing of the church bell had been a gift. It had given her the ability to mark time. She counted everything now. The number of weeks they'd been gone, the number of stairs to the locked door, the number of times the other man came, the number of times he'd forced her to do that. But the bell also meant that one more week had passed, and her mother and father hadn't yet come for them. She feared that what the man said was true, that her parents had given up on them, that they didn't care. Tonight, neither the man nor the other man had come downstairs, but now that reprieve vanished in importance. Now more bells began to ring. Was this upheaval a new trick? But how could the man enlist everyone? Outside, people were yelling. No, this was something else. Something the man didn't cause. Though in their new world, nothing happened that the man didn't make happen. Her mother loved the sound of church bells, except when it was the middle of the night. When it was the middle of the night, the bells signified something terrible, Emma remembered. Her mind churned as she struggled to remember what her mother said they meant. Outside, flashes of candle and lantern light flickered past the window boxes. People were up. People were awake. When the bells rang, her mother would leap from her bed. She would throw open the window and call out, "What?" Oh, her mind was working so slowly. Too slowly. Fire or flood? Cradling Claire in her arms, Emma forced herself to make her thoughts as ordered as the rungs on that ladder to the sky. She didn't smell smoke, but she couldn't be certain. Sometimes the coal stove smoked, and sometimes everything smelled of it. And when it did, she didn't smell other, loathsome things. Emma put away her fear, because she might need to do something. Think one thought at a time, she told herself. Down here, shut up in the basement, she might not smell smoke. So it was possible that the bells meant fire. But maybe it was just early in the morning. Maybe it was a holiday. Easter was coming. She remembered that she was to have had a new dress for the holiday. Her mother had promised to make it for her. Maybe it was Easter now? Did bells ring like this on Easter? No. Easter came on Sunday. It wasn't Sunday. Outside, wagons were creaking past. Someone set a lantern down near one window box. No one was hurrying. Hurrying would mean fire. So it must be flood. In flood, there was always time. She and her father had once gone to the lapping edge of a freshet on Broadway and watched an eddy carry away bales of hay from an upturned packet boat. But she didn't know whether they were above or below Broadway now. The man wouldn't tell them where they were. She knew only that after the other man had picked them up, he had driven them in his sleigh toward the river. And now train and boat whistles sounded almost all the time, and it felt as if they were so close that she sometimes dreamed that those sounds could carry them away, like that eddy. Claire was still crying. Had the man gone out? Sometimes he did at night, when the other man didn't come. But she'd fallen asleep. Maybe they were alone. She couldn't tell. Was he here? Where was he? Would he save them? Oh, she didn't want to drown. Sometimes people did. That's why they lived up high, her father told her. That's why they lived up away from the river. Sometimes the man's voice in her dream sounded like her father's. Come up, come away, it called. She heard keys jangling in the lock, and a sliver of light from the opening door spilled down the stairs. Candlelight jounced around the basement, glinting off the shiny tip of the coal shovel. "Hello, doves!" the man's awful voice shrieked from the top of the stairs. "Don't be afraid of those nasty bells! I'm here!" Chapter 16. At dawn, James Harley sputtered and reared upward onto his hands and knees, grabbing at a hellish pain at the back of his head. Wheezing, disoriented, he pulled his hand away. Blood was smeared across his palm. Stumbling to his feet, he took in the strange sight of the remnants of his winter coal bobbing on blackened water, a scrap of blanket drifting toward him, and a bed submerged under the opaque surface of the pooling mess. His brain worked hard to make sense of what he was seeing. He had lost something, he thought. Yes, that was it. Something vaguely new and wonderful that had given him so much happiness of late. Woozy, he reached for a pillar. His shirt and trousers dripped with water. At his feet, the tip of his coal shovel protruded from the surface of the water. He picked it up. Staring at it, he tried to understand the odd confluence of seeping water, brutal headache, bloodied shovel, and the dispiriting sense of loss that now overwhelmed him. Water was rising past his ankles, seeping up from the ground, trickling through the walls, pouring in through the windows. He must get out of here. Yes, this is what he must do. Driven by this sudden clarity, he dropped the shovel into the half-foot of water rapidly overtaking his cellar and waded the few feet to the stairs. He climbed the wooden staircase on his hands and knees, fighting dizziness. Upstairs, he scrambled across the plank floor of his kitchen, staggering to his feet when he reached the back door. He flung it open. Water coursed down the alley. 2, 6 inches? More? Sunlight flickered off the water. His neighbors were spilling into the alleyway. One of them, a short, stout woman in a red kerchief, clung to a weathered fire escape. She had knotted a blanket around her chest, and from it came the muffled wailing of an infant. He knew the woman by sight, though not her name. She lived down the street, one of the many impoverished women whose boys wandered shoeless in the summer and hatless in the winter. Her boys clung to her, the youngest with one arm slung around her neck, his legs cinched around her waist, the older hanging onto the ties of her dirty apron. He was submerged to his waist at her side, wailing. The children's high-pitched screams ricocheted off the water. The screaming finally accomplished what the water had not. It restored his foggy memory. Stricken, he turned. In his confusion, had he missed them? Left them in the cellar? Had he locked the door? Were they inside, drowning? Or had they somehow escaped upstairs? He replayed his awakening in his mind. Had the door to the cellar been open when he woke? Usually he locked it going in and out, but now he couldn't remember. "In the name of God, James Harley, you've got to help me," the woman cried. How would he explain Emma and Claire to anyone? Even if he could get down into the cellar and back again without being drowned, what would the girls do when they were free? Start talking, maybe. Tell everyone. And then, oh God, then, it would be the end of him. He looked yearningly at the door to his house. Water was already breaking over the threshold, pouring in. Surely the basement was nearly full now. Torn between returning to save them and saving himself, he hesitated. His choice so painful, he could hardly breathe. Surely the girls were already dead. Or would be. Soon. It occurred to him now that he ought perhaps to have relayed the fact that the pastures had a tendency to flood when he agreed to house the girls. But he'd not been given much choice. Harley ventured into the alley, first one step, then another, then scuttled backward and pressed his body against the house. The water was numbingly cold and rising fast. Within moments it would pass his knees. He had to go now. Harley struck out across the alley, raising a hand to indicate to the shrieking woman that he was on his way. Twice the current nearly took him. The woman screamed again and again for him to hurry. When he reached her, she turned so that he could peel the young boy off her back. Nimbly, the boy scrambled onto Harley's shoulders and grabbed at the cut on his neck. Harley's knees buckled from the searing pain. Terrified, the boy reared backward, and Harley lost balance and they both fell into the water. Harley struggled to his feet and fished the boy out by his wrist, warning him through gritted teeth to not touch his neck again or he'd be sorry. The frightened boy nodded. The older boy wrapped his arms around Harley's right thigh, and they all plunged westward, trailed by the woman cradling the blanket and its wailing contents to her chest. They fought their way up the alley, crossed Franklin and Pearl Streets, forged on. More than a few pounds too heavy, the woman stopped frequently to catch her breath. The boys would not let Harley proceed without their mother at their side. They marched in fits and starts another three blocks up the slow rise of Madison, where the water lapped finally at dry pavement on Grand Street. There, Harley plucked the children from his back and leg and sank to the ground, where an ever-growing crowd was seeking refuge. Exhausted, Harley hung his head between his knees, breathing hard, his neck throbbing. The woman sprawled on the pavement beside him and regaled anyone who would listen about his kindness. He had saved her children, and couldn't they tell the poor man was hurt? A lurking journalist, in danger of losing his job if he didn't come up with an interesting concoction, story, sooner rather than later, interrogated the woman, encouraging embellishment. And when she failed to comply, embellished his notes himself, inventing and shaping, hardly noticing when Harley slumped sideways onto the cobbles. Everyone took far too long to notice the nasty welt at the base of his skull. For a moment, the reporter contemplated the possibility that the man's death might provide a more rousing and satisfactory end to his story. But he was too weak a person to lead a life of remorse. He commandeered a carriage to ferry them to City Hospital, and as it jounced up the cobbled hill, the reporter cradled Harley's head in his lap, careful not to touch the gaping wound that would prove his subject's heroism. Chapter 17. At the Vanderveer mansion, when the bells commenced their interminable peal, the doctors Stipp and their family extracted themselves from the party, and Harold, already waiting outside, drove them to City Hospital at a rapid trot. The streets of the city seethed with panic. Drays and carts were fleeing uphill, away from the river, their coach lights winking. Harold shouted for news, and they were fed bits and pieces. Yes, it was the ice. The gas along the riverfront was already out. The water was a devil. At Eagle Street, traffic was stoppered by a bottleneck, and Harold could go no farther, and he had no choice but to deposit them into the swirling eddies of humankind. The hospital loomed at the corner of Eagle and Howard Streets. 3 stories, a basement, a new wing along Eagle Street, and a hexagonal Victorian tower, its windows lit tonight by candles in lieu of the usual gas. The building was a former jail, and though much money had been spent in fashioning a pleasing transformation, its dark stone facade still put a chill into Mary's heart. They pushed through a crowd to the steep stairs of the hospital entrance. They had already determined that Mary and William would attend to whatever presented itself in the accident ward. Amelia would treat any laboring women, and Elizabeth would be helpful in whatever way she could. Dressed in their finery, they made an incongruous picture among the refugee patients. "You'll be fine," Mary assured Elizabeth as they donned aprons, telling her niece that instinct would serve her well. Immediately, the nurse in charge put Elizabeth to work, arming her with pen and ink and ledger so that she could record patients' names. Mary and William surveyed the crowded corridors, picking their way around sprawled limbs and sleeping children. St. Peter's Hospital on Broadway usually treated these kinds of trauma because of its proximity to the railroad, where accidents occurred almost daily. But apparently the flood had inundated St. Peter's, and dozens of patients were stranded on its upper floors. Any and all victims, no matter how wounded, were being sent to City. The accident ward was downstairs, flush with Eagle Street, to allow for stretchers to be carried in. So far, the injuries seemed to be mostly the result of the general frenzy, cuts and bruises and mild shock from fright. Since there were no women in labor, the same nurse in charge marshaled Amelia's services to perform basic triage. She was to send those with bruised shins, broken fingers, and minor cuts upstairs to wait their turn. The more troubling cases called for immediate attention. These were arriving trundled up from the waterfront in jolting wagons, for the hospital board had yet to fund ambulances. "Have any other physicians come to help?" Mary said. "Just you and Dr. Stipp," the nurse said, shaking her head. They were inundated. The accident ward was filling up. One man had shattered his feet by dropping something heavy on them, and William wheeled him to the operating room. Mary splinted a woman's broken arm and leg, making a mental note to fashion her proper casts during a lull, but she could wait several days if necessary. Mary pulled a sheet over the head of a woman trampled by a runaway horse. Albert Vanderveer, distant cousin to Garrett, arrived around 1 in the morning. He had also served as a surgeon in the War of the Rebellion. His brother, also named Garrett, but with the more traditional spelling, had been a lieutenant colonel in the war, but was killed in action in the Battle of Olustee in Florida. Unlike most of his compatriots, the younger doctor had welcomed Mary to the staff of the hospital when the Stipps arrived from Manhattan City. He was particularly skilled, like William, in orthopedics. Together, he and Mary operated on an open fracture, using techniques developed during and after the war. William set a broken humerus under anesthesia. In this way, the night lingered on, with complicated cases punctuating ever-lengthening periods of bandaging and soothing, the three doctors falling into the familiar rhythm of the marathon surgery sessions of the war. At 7 a.m., when an entire hour had gone by without a new patient, Albert van der Veer went home. It was then that Mary and William found themselves at the side of an unconscious man who had suffered an odd blow to the base of his skull, which looked, for all the world, as if he had been hit across the back of his neck by a sword or a shovel. "Do you know him?" William asked the gaunt rail of a man at his side, who was keeping intense watch. "Not his name," the young man said, "but he's the hero of the flood." William and Mary peered at their patient's bloodied face, prominent jaw, and stolid build. "William, we know him. Isn't this Mr. Harley?" Mary said. "Gerrit van der Veer's overseer?" It was. The cut had swelled, distorting the features of his face, but it was indeed James Harley. They rushed him into the operating amphitheater. They spent a good deal of time washing out the gash, which smelled of sewer water and railroad grease. The blow had somehow not severed the spine, but the cut was a perfect slice down to the sixth cervical vertebra. The vertebral process was exposed, glistening white in its pillow of red tissue. A chip of the bone had been cut away. Even with surgical intervention, there would be more swelling and pain, probably for a good long while. He had likely suffered concussion, too, though they needed to wait to assess the extent of the danger. However, they both agreed he would be one lucky man if he emerged from this with only a ripping headache and sore neck. In the end, their task was mostly a matter of careful stitching. They saw Harley safely upstairs to a clean bed, where the young man from before was writing in a notebook. He leaped up and extended his hand.
"Horace Young, I'm a reporter with the Argus. Tell me, how is our hero?"
They answered the young man's questions, repeating several times in different ways that the outlook for Harley's recovery was still undetermined.
"I see. Well, I'm going to write a story about our hero."
"Why do you keep calling him that?" Mary asked.
"Don't you know? He saved two children."
"Two children?" Mary swallowed and exchanged a swift glance with William, allowing herself a moment of hope. "Girls?" The reporter shook his head.
"Two little boys. Mr. Harley helped them through the floodwaters. Isn't that a great story? You saved the life of a man who saved the lives of children."
"But are you certain they weren't girls?" Young peered at her from under a layer of pale eyelashes. His scrutiny gave off the foul taint of a vulture.
"Wait, I know who you are. Stip, that's your name, isn't it? Of course. You are those doctors who wouldn't give up on those sisters who died in the blizzard. That's why you asked whether or not the children were girls. But you buried them the other day, didn't you? I read the notice in the Argus."
William followed Mary as she turned away and strode down the hallway, sick of the cavalier way people mentioned Emma and Claire's disappearance.
"Wait," Young called. "I want to write about your part in all of this, too. A woman doctor is so interesting. What does your husband think of your unusual profession?"
"Unusual profession," Mary said, wheeling around. "First at the party, from Abraham Lansing, and now this reporter."
"As opposed to what? A laundress or a prostitute? Is that what you are implying? Or ought I to become a writer so that I, too, could ask idiotic questions while making ridiculous assumptions about what people ought and ought not to do?"
He caught up to them, breathless. Didn't she grasp that they, too, were heroes for saving Harley's life? Didn't she understand that her name would be honored throughout the city? Didn't she realize how free advertisement like this would help her? William seized Young by the elbow and bellowed, "Ye God, man! Have you no sense? Leave us alone!" On the way home, the chaos of the night before had subsided, though the traffic was still heavy. It was cold. Outside the thick stone walls of the hospital, you could hear the ice marshaling its forces and pushing ever southward. Mary laid her head against the hood strut of their carriage, exhausted. Amelia had already fallen asleep, and Elizabeth was nodding off opposite Mary. Only William was alert, interrogating Harold on what he had heard of the flood damages. Throughout the night, Mary had glimpsed Elizabeth at her duties, and her niece had appeared competent and engaged, an encouraging sign that Amelia and Mary had acknowledged to one another, using the tools of concerned parents everywhere, mute and fleeting expressions of approval and relief, which they assumed their children never saw, and which their children always did. As the carriage crested the hill on Madison, it occurred to Mary that she ought to send a note to the Vanderveers to tell them about James Harley's injury. She shot straight up, recalling only now that Jacob had left with Harley to go to the lumber district. At least that was what Garrett had explained after Jacob and Harley bolted from the room. Something, Garrett had said, about retrieving the company's books. But if Harley had been hurt, then what about Jacob? Had he, too, been caught in the flood? Too drained by the night's demands, she and William hadn't yet told Elizabeth or Amelia that they had treated Harley. She debated now whether or not to raise the alarm, but she decided not to. It would only cause unnecessary worry and concern. In her note to the Vanderveers, she would ask after Jacob. She would wait to see what they replied before mentioning anything. It was, after all, a good sign that Jacob hadn't been admitted. When they pulled up to their house, it was Elizabeth who climbed out first and noticed the policeman seated on their front steps. And another moment still, before she saw that his arms were wrapped around two sleeping girls, their heads resting in his lap. Book 2 Chapter 18 By 8 in the morning, the damage the flooding had caused was visible everywhere along the waterfront. Jagged ice piled along the shore had been overtopped by river water, brimming with all the flotsam it had dredged along its path. Carriage wheels, horse whips, sidewalk planking, uprooted trees, roof beams, drowned livestock, a child's hobby horse, and one spiraling dervish of a cart. In the middle of the river channel, great mountains of ice abutted the North Bridge supports. A house floated past, completely intact until it cracked against the bridge and smashed to pieces. On a smaller floe, a rooster flapped its wings and crowed. A steam tug had gone keel up and jutted against a remnant of the pier. On shore, roiling water enveloped the buildings along the quay to at least the second floor, making canals of the streets, and even swirling into the gasworks between Lawrence and North Lansing, tearing away piping. The Hudson inundated warehouses and homes alike, wetted grain as well as silk, inconvenienced both the rich and the poor, defied the careful and the careless, swamped the Erie Canal, sloshed upward to the D&H railroad tracks, and sundered the city's main waterline from its anchors. From his lofty perch on the roof of Vanderveer Lumber, Jacob shifted uncomfortably in his oiled boots. His pants were soaked to the knees, and the cooling breeze that rippled the surface of the muddy, littered sea chilled him to the bone. He'd spent the night huddled in a corner of the roof, up against the chimney. From time to time, the moon had come out from behind a cloud, but the silvery light had been insufficient to pinpoint the rise of the river. Chopping through the ceiling into the attic, and then onto the roof itself, he'd worked up a good sweat. But in the freezing hours of the early morning, his perspiration had evaporated, leaving him wet and chilled through. In the cold, his thinking had sometimes grown confused, and he had to remember not to pace to warm himself, because he didn't want to risk forgetting that there was a hole in the roof. Occasionally, he stood and swung his arms and stamped his feet, but for the most part, there was nothing to do but stare into the darkness and wait, terrified and impotent. Fearing that he might lose consciousness in the bitter cold, he relived sitting with Elizabeth on the neighbor's stoop as she revealed her heartache to him about her time in Paris. As she talked, he had discovered that she was not as fragile as her delicate beauty made her appear. From time to time, flashes of steely resolve had emerged, rendering her even more attractive to him. Now he swept his gaze 360 degrees, taking in his watery view. The world had turned upside down. The river and its vast cargo of broken ice surged a few feet below him, skirting his father's sturdy building that had so far refused to give way. Only a few of the better-built lumber offices still stood, their steep roofs holding firm against the deluge. The saloon had disappeared. The telegraph poles were all toppled and tangled together, roped by the silver wires still strung between them. The chapel steeple bobbed on its side. The overwintered stacks of milled lumber that had filled the 100-acre district had vanished. Even the board feet that had been rushed last night onto packet boats in hopes of salvaging at least some of the stock. Not a single island of lumber protruded from the river's sunlit surface. Vanderveer and Son, indeed every lumber merchant, had just lost a great deal of money. Jacob thought back to Sunday, the night his father had returned late from somewhere and woken him, malt liquor and scotch mingling on his breath, a vague satisfaction playing across his weathered features. He'd perched tipsily on the edge of Jacob's bed, and gone on and on about his plans for the coming year, the money they would make. As gaslight hissed from the wall sconce, Jacob nodded, barely listening, because his father sought not approval but an audience, a function Jacob had performed for him ever since returning from Harvard. He knew his father regarded these sessions as Jacob's real education, which Jacob did not dispute out of a fervent wish to keep the peace, because any conflict only meant more misery for his mother. Jacob recalled that before his father had left, he'd leaned in confidingly, the stale smell of the liquor mingling with the perpetual pine sap.
"Just so you know, son, love, regard, these are the most important things in the world. Not even money matters as much."
His father had steadied himself at the door jamb before radiating a beatifying smile of contentedness, which Jacob was certain was not reflective of amorous feelings for his mother. Jacob had only recently become aware of his father's adulterous inclinations. A week ago, at a gathering at his father's club, to which Jacob had recently been admitted on the strength of his father's money, he'd watched his father ogle a young barmaid and remarked to a fellow member,
"Wouldn't you like to get her up against a wall?"
The man had shrugged a half-smile, then walked away as Garrett hitched up his pants. Garrett turned to his son, a sly grin of defiance blooming across his face when he noticed Jacob watching. In his confusion and revulsion, Jacob had not said anything. But now, facing the possibility of death, he felt ashamed that he hadn't confronted his father. Jacob shook off the sordid memory. His mother would be frantic, wondering where he was. He searched the shore for any indication that help was on its way. It stood now perhaps 300 yards distant, double its true length. He shouted and waved his arms, but he knew no one would hear him. The river was too loud. Unbuttoning his dinner jacket, he yanked it off and waved it overhead. He was cold, but the exertion hardly warmed him. He was hungry, too, but that problem could not be solved. He went on like this for a while, pushing away the obvious perils involved in any attempted rescue, but finally he acknowledged with a shiver that the river was too fast, the water too high. Defeated, he wrapped himself in his coat and huddled back against the chimney, his desperate ruminations distracting him enough that he missed the great shudder of yet another ice house giving way in the basin. The river was a shifting demon. It was impossible to tell what it would do next. And then, with breathtaking rapidity, great slabs of ice groaned to a stop, then climbed over one another, effectively stoppering all the ice behind it. As Jacob watched, a frozen crust formed suddenly between him and the shore. What had moments before been a raging river was now an ice dam. A dam with incredible weight and force behind it, but solid all the same. He knew at once that it could crush the building he was standing on. Crush him, too. But it might yield passage, if he could summon the courage to cross it. Terror rocketed through him, recalling his summers of dislodging log jams, the leaping from one floating log to another, the jabbing at bottlenecks with pikes, all of it a dangerous gamble where one misstep could prove fatal. Those dams broke suddenly, and occasionally men were carried away and drowned. A dangerous business, that. This dam, too, could break at any moment. But he could feel the mounting pressure of the ice forcing itself against the building. If he didn't chance the river, he might be killed here anyway. Either choice might be suicide. His foot knocked against the heavy burlap bag stuffed with his father's books, the reason he was stuck here. It would be foolish to take them. Far easier to gain footing without them. But then, what had all this been for? His father's words, "Love is more important than money." Jacob wasn't convinced his father believed that for a second. There was the terrible crunch of shattering window glass. Jacob scooped up the bag and hugged it to his chest. In a second, he dropped 3 feet from the mansard roof down onto the uneven, shifting surface of the temporary, frozen lake. The slab of ice rocked precariously. He sprang off it onto its neighbor, then dashed pell-mell toward the city. The treacherous footing shifted from second to second. He juggled the heavy bag and grabbed for purchase here and there, taking hold of the odd protrusion to propel himself forward. At every moment, it felt as if the ice were about to give way. It happened like that. Ice dammed, then shifted, and then dammed again, then broke through and became liquid once more. He was breathing hard. Small shards of ice coated his cheeks, making them rigid with cold. As he neared shore, he began to hear shouts of encouragement. From the top of Cammon's piano factory, spectators were calling to him, urging him on. He was so close. With one last leap, he hurled himself forward, wrenched himself between two enormous upended slabs, handed the bag through the crevice, then squeezed into the crack just as the river ice broke behind him. One marooned mountain of ice to go. He scaled it and then clambered down the other side, into 3 feet of relatively still water on Rathbone Street, where he splashed into the arms of a waiting policeman who'd been alerted to his desperate status by the onlookers. "What daft idiot are you?" the policeman demanded, hauling him upright. "Out on the ice like that? And what the bloody hell is this?" he continued, snatching the burlap sack from Jacob's hands. "Looted goods?" "No." Jacob, his hands to his knees, was breathing hard. "Vanderveer Lumber's books. My father's books.
Christ almighty, boy. You Vanderveers really do like your money.
Jacob was too exhausted to explain. He let the policeman haul him and his bag through the knee-high water to Broadway, the officer shouting that they had been ousted from their own precinct house by the flood and had their hands full without daredevils like Jacob testing themselves. He muttered that looting had broken out at the city hotel and that loiterers were taking to fisticuffs over food, apparently not having heard that City Hall had been flung open to the displaced, with mayoral orders to provide everything necessary for comfort. The policeman hailed an enterprising boatman rowing down the flooded thoroughfare and heaved Jacob and his sack into the boat with a hearty pat to his back. The oarsman bore Jacob around the Matamor coal and wood yard, over the submerged tracks of the New York Central Railroad's Tivoli Hollow line, and past the number 9 police station, then led him off at the base of State Street, across from the flooded post office, where a crowd had gathered, held back by a line of policemen. Jacob sloshed through a foot of freezing water and sank onto a dry square of pavement against the First National Bank building, shivering, with the company's books pressed against his chest. He heard a shriek and someone call his name. Then he sank into a dreamless sleep. Chapter 19. Elizabeth broke and ran toward the veranda, comprehending a second earlier than everyone else. Amelia gasped and followed, and Mary and William ran behind, their footsteps on the flagstone a warning drumbeat they would later remember as the herald of everything that followed. The girls. Anyone passing would think the family had lost their minds. And perhaps they had. Their dead had returned. The dead never return, and yet theirs had. They sank onto the veranda steps, surrounding the policemen and Emma and Claire. The girls sat up and rubbed their eyes, pulling away from the policeman, who did not relinquish his firm grip around their shoulders. They were still mirrors of one another, with those high cheekbones and wide blue eyes rimmed with thick lashes, like curtains, their long copper hair shimmering in the cold morning light. And they had been fed, clearly, though their hair was tangled. No one but the policemen wondered yet why they were wearing only nightgowns. No one noticed that their bare feet were mottled with cold. They were seeing only the girls, resurrected.
"I stumbled across them in the alleyway behind Ferry Street," the policeman said, his fair hair glinting in the early rays of the sun. "That's in the pastures. They were sleeping all alone up against a wooden fence. I'm glad I found them when I did. The pastures is underwater now. Most of the basement's filled up. The sober citizens were already packing their wagons by the time I started knocking on doors. That was my job. Most got out. God help the others. Though I think most folks got out when the bells started. But the pastures always floods late 'cause the water gets dammed up under the South Bridge. It's not like before the bridges were built, when the whole city went under at once."
They hardly heard him. Time had reversed itself, and all the rules of the world had been broken just for them. Amelia was petting Claire's hair. It was a raft of tangle and dirt. Elizabeth had reached out and taken a hold of Emma's hand. Mary, her eyes glassy with tears, wiped them away. It was a miracle. A mirage. Everyone was trying to catch their breath.
"They're skittish," the policeman warned, though no one was paying any attention to him. "I woke them out of a sound sleep. The bells were ringing like no one's business, and they were sleeping. Then I couldn't believe it when they told me their names. I asked them again, and that's when they ran."
They had torn away from him as if he were the devil himself, he said. He'd yelled over the din, "Emma, Claire, we've been looking for you." He chased after them and swung them into his arms and pinned them there while he said how the whole world was worried about them, and that people had been searching for them for a long time. The family was only half listening. They were intoxicated. The girls are here. The girls are alive. The girls are back. The policeman talked on.
I can usually spot them, the little ones on their own who don't like it out there. First, I thought maybe they belonged to somebody. Everyone was out on the streets. But I got the pictures soon enough.
He seemed to be spinning words, not wanting to come out with something, as if there was something they didn't yet understand. The sleeve of Emma's nightgown inched up her arm, and she seized it and tugged it back into place. It was a small gesture, innocuous. The policeman buried her up to her shoulders under his greatcoat. No one was heeding the cold.
It was bedlam in the streets, you understand.
The policeman couldn't get to the point. He was going around it and under it, backtracking. Anything but saying it straight out. Mary noticed that the girls' dazed expressions seemed not to be registering where they were. They were as silent as their granite statue. Vanished was any trace of Emma's spirited confidence, Claire's sparkling happiness. Flesh. Yes, here. Yes, but they exhibited no exultation. Their gaze focused on nothing and no one. They were blank. Blurred. Grandmama, Elizabeth said.
Yes, Lizzie. Isn't it wonderful?
Amelia caressed Emma's shoulder and wiped a smudge of dirt from her face. Emma flinched and pulled away. The policeman repeated his stories. Ferry Street. Tried to get away. Measuring every word while they all peered at Emma and Claire, studying them as they hadn't before. Was that a bruise? What was that on Claire's collar? It wasn't blood, was it?
I asked them who they were, and I couldn't believe it. Not at first, the policeman said.
He was repeating himself. The sisters were saying nothing.
They talked to you,
William said, his eyes narrowing.
They did.
Officer Farrell?
Mary said, finally recognizing him as the policeman from her visits to the precinct house, and then from the day Mantell had come to the clinic, the one who had remembered about Emma and Claire.
Wondered when you'd notice.
Colm Farrell was less effusive now.
They knew their names. I couldn't believe it. Had to ask them twice. When they told me, I thought, what the hell, I'd let the drunks drown. I didn't have a wagon with me, so I carried them up the hill. From the pastures,
William said, keen now to every detail.
All that way?
Officer Farrell still had Emma and Claire by their shoulders. It was clear now to everyone that he didn't mean to let them go.
I stopped first by their house. They'd given me the address, 46 Elm Street. That's how I knew for sure it was them. Cross the street from the brewery, up from that orphanage?
He was stalling.
Another family had already moved into the rooms. I don't know what I was thinking. I didn't know what to tell them. Then I remembered you.
He nodded at Mary.
That's when I brought them here.
The story took sudden shape as they all studied the girls and really saw them for the first time. Their skin was sallow and sickeningly pale. Their eyes were glazed and blank, and both girls seemed unreachable. Mary marked the dirt under their fingernails, the rigid way they held their arms tight to their sides.
I didn't know what to tell them, the policeman repeated. What exactly did you say?
William said.
I said we had to come here first, that they needed to see a doctor.
Officer Farrell shifted. His voice grew raw.
There's something not quite right. They were asleep when I found them. I've had a chance to study them here while they were sleeping and we were waiting for you.